remembered answering the phone, and I said, "Have you found her?" And he said, "I hope you're sitting down."
The homicide squad has been called in to investigate the death of a woman in Melbourne. The 24-year-old's body was discovered last night on the ground floor of a St Kilda Road apartment building.
As soon as I found out how she died, ostensibly by climbing into a garbage chute when she was pissed.
I don't think she climbed in there by herself.
I have no idea how anybody thinks anybody could get in that thing.
She may have been alive while I was standing there chatting, and given a litre or two of intravenous fluid, wouldn't be dead.
No, she didn't get justice by the system because the finding was a complete dud. It was a farce.
It wasn't just like this sadness of, oh, Phoebe has killed herself. There was far more to it.
This is Phoebe's Fall, a podcast from the Age newsroom in Melbourne. I'm Michael Batchelard.
And I'm Richard Baker.
And we've been investigating the short life and brutal death of Phoebe Handsjuck.
Melbourne, Thursday, the 2nd of December, 2010. At 7 o'clock on this summer evening, it was still hot and muggy. At a luxury apartment building, the concierge made her way to the refuse room on the ground floor. There'd been a fire alarm, and she was looking for a broom to sweep up a mess. When she turned the key, something blocked the door. She gave the door a shove. It shifted a bit, and she peered in. She saw the body of a young woman lying in a pool of blood among the fallen bins. Somehow, 12 floors above, this young woman had squeezed through a narrow hatch, 1 metre off the floor, and fallen feet first, 40 metres, down the galvanised steel chute. But it wasn't the fall that killed her. The blade of a hydraulic compactor virtually severed her foot before the machine spat her out. Blood, smeared on the floor, shows that she crawled around the room, looking for an exit, until she bled to death from her injuries, alone and in the dark.
The mystery here is how she got into the chute. The coroner considered the possibilities of murder and suicide. What he ruled was neither. He said Phoebe climbed in herself, in a haze of drugs and alcohol, but that she had not intended to kill herself. According to him, this was just a tragic accident. It's an account her family simply does not believe.
Hey.
Hi, Natalie.
Hi,
how
Richard.
You going? Good to see you.
Good. Good to see you too. Yeah.
So, Richard, you've been following this story for years now. What first drew you to it?
Well, Phoebe's mum, Natalie Handsjuck, asked me about 4 years ago to have a look into what might have happened to Phoebe. So I did have a look, and I still can't let it go.
I remember the story from when you first reported it, and what really struck me then is such a bizarre death.
Do you have a rough estimate of how many, I guess, suspicious deaths you'd been called out to over those years?
I'd have run into hundreds.
Had you ever been called out to a scene where someone had died in a garbage chute?
No. I've been to several leaps from balconies, but none through a garbage chute.
That's Roland Legg, one of Victoria's most experienced homicide detectives. We asked him to review Phoebe's case, and we'll be hearing a lot more from him later on.
In the backdrop, there's the spectre of drugs and booze and high society. Phoebe lived with her much older boyfriend, Anthony Hampel, at the time of her death.
Yeah, she did. In fact, Ant instructed his lawyers to oppose a coronial inquest. His father's a prominent retired judge, and his stepmother is a sitting county court judge.
But an inquest was held, and at this point we need to note that the coroner ultimately exonerated Ant Hampel from having any involvement in or knowledge of the circumstances of Phoebe's death, and we're not suggesting otherwise.
But we are re-examining how she died and the controversial aftermath.
Richard, it seems like from the very first, on the night she was discovered, that Phoebe and her family were let down by the system.
Yeah, that's right. No one checked her for signs of life. No one grabbed the CCTV footage from the building. It was assumed that this was suicide very quickly. And that's despite there being no fingerprints on the entrance to the garbage chute. There was blood in the apartment and there was also broken glass in the apartment.
You hope that The system is there to protect, you know, the average person, but it's sort of not, is the harsh reality of it.
A beautiful young girl's lost her life. She's just been treated like a piece of garbage.
That's Phoebe's brother Tom and her mother Natalie. The family believes the evidence only permitted the coroner to come up with an open finding, meaning that there wasn't enough evidence to say exactly what happened. And this is what her grandfather Lorne thinks.
No, she didn't get justice by the system because the finding was a complete dud. It was a farce.
Lorne's not just Phoebe's grandfather. He's also a retired detective.
This is a poem I wrote for Grandma Marsha. After all the fear, the fighting, after all, strength gave way to final rest, a place to lay your weary head. Your body strong but heavy as lead. Never faltered in generous step, your arms held wide to those who needed compassion, a little warmth inside.
You gave That's Phoebe at her paternal grandmother's funeral.
I hope you now have found a place of peace, kindness and tenderness. For those of us you leave behind, we will carry these memories in our hearts. We'll keep you safe inside.
Well, that was recorded 2 months before Phoebe died. And that clip only came to me recently. It was the first time I'd ever heard Phoebe talk. And her voice sounds so different to what I was expecting, what I had in my head. Her voice is so much stronger and deeper than what I thought it would be.
She obviously had real presence. In fact, her friends say she had an electrifying effect on people, particularly on men.
I remember when we used to go out or anywhere, she would walk into the room and there was these just cat eyes that would scan and you could just see everybody just turning slowly, looking and stopping to see her.
She always had a lot of mystery around her, probably because she was so beautiful and she had this intense power and intense sort of eye contact and... she was very creative and always was, it, you know, just even in a very private way, she was very creative in her journals and drawing all the time.
That's Alicia Carville and Hazel Brown, two of Phoebe's closest friends. They went to school together in Melbourne. Phoebe's childhood was idyllic. She lived with her mum, Natalie, dad, Len, and brothers Tom and Nikolai in a big house on a large block in inner Melbourne.
We were sort of, on the outside, the perfect family. The kids just had a great childhood.
Charmed life.
A charmed life, yes.
If you asked anyone who knew Phoebe when she was growing up, they'd tell you that her closest buddy was her brother Tom.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she was always up for, you know, a good time and where, you know, be like, oh, you know, that tree looks a bit difficult to climb. She'd be like, no, let's, you know, go for it and everything. She was a lot more adventurous than I was. I played a lot more safe, but she was always up for it, I guess.
That unconventional streak stayed with Phoebe, as her friend Alicia remembers.
I set her up a job at McDonald's and she got it, obviously. We would have been like 16 years old and she had her first shift, that was okay. Then the second shift she decided she didn't like working there anymore. So she went out into the ice room and you have to return your uniform, you have to pay for it. So she took off her uniform, left it in the ice room, ran out the back door and ran home in her underwear. So that was the kind of person that she was. She just did what she didn't like something, she was out.
So, Rich, we're on the road today. We're heading from Melbourne up to Mallacoota. What's the significance of Mallacoota?
Well, Mallacoota is a pretty special place for Phoebe. It's obviously where her mother, Natalie, lives now. And also someone really special in Phoebe's life, which is her grandmother called Jeanette Campbell. She's Natalie's mum. And of all the people in Phoebe's family, everyone says Jeanette was her confidant.
Yes, mum.
Oh, hi, Jeanette.
I'm
Richard.
Hi, Richard. I do remember you. Probably don't remember me.
I saw you.
Well, the whole basis of my relationship with her was her faith that she could tell me anything and that it wasn't going to go any further. It was that we would talk about it and that was it.
Jeanette was a non-judgmental grandmother, but she was still concerned about Phoebe.
Having used LSD myself and found that that was something that I just could not take, I talked with her about that, you know, some people just simply cannot and should not take stuff like this because you are really very, very sensitive and this is just going to take you over the top and it's very hard to come back.
We started going out when we were 13, so we were using fake IDs and going to the clubs when we were 13 years old. We had no money, like literally no money. And we would go out and on $20 and come home with copious amounts of drinks, and Phoebe would come home with a handful of drugs that guys, men, would just give it to her. I don't know how she got it. She'd disappear and then that was the end.
She would have been 14, 15, you know, really developing brain that just shouldn't have had that sort of substance. I think it did change her. It just amplified the already sensitive, mercurial character that she was. It just made it worse. That's all.
Drugs and alcohol are at the very heart of the mystery surrounding Phoebe's death. The night she plunged down the garbage chute, she had just taken the sleeping drug Stilnox and had a blood alcohol content of 0.16, just over three times the legal driving limit. The coroner used this as an explanation. He found that Phoebe climbed through the chute in a drug-induced haze. He concluded that her death was a tragic accident. But her family have seen her when she was drunk. They say to imagine she could have lifted herself up to the height of the entry hatch and then squeezed in by herself is, well, impossible.
And I had a little bit of experience of Phoebe and her intolerance to liquor. I knew that she lost her sea legs very quickly.
And it wasn't just booze and party drugs. Phoebe was also using prescription medication to deal with some pretty dramatic mood swings.
She'd been on antidepressants since she was about 16, which neither Len or I agreed with. We were always very concerned about her on them, and she used to go on and off them herself, which is very dangerous.
One of the challenges in life is to feel the turbulence and to just hold on, and gradually it sorts itself out.
That's Phoebe's dad, Len Hansjuk. He's a psychiatrist.
I've always body surfed. There'd be 2 days in the summer where there would be a 2 metre wave would come through, and it was ripping. And if you get dumped on one of those, right, if you panic, you're in trouble. But all you have to do is tuck up, hold your breath, wait till it settles, and then you float to the surface and take a breath. It's a matter of how we manage turbulence, not that it exists.
When Len and Natalie split up in Phoebe's teenage years, it turned her life upside down. Len and Phoebe didn't have a lot to do with each other for a few years, but they repaired their relationship later on. Len believes that by the time Phoebe was 24, she was sorting things out.
I know she wasn't disturbed, right? I know she wasn't depressed. She didn't hold her booze and would get sort of morose afterwards.
So it's pretty clear that Phoebe's got her issues.
Yeah, but among her friends, the sort of things she was dealing with weren't that unusual.
You could ask any of her friends, any of our friends from our class at that age, how they're feeling. They've probably got boyfriend issues, they're probably depressed, they're probably, half of them are on medication. It's such a normal thing to feel emotional and depressed.
From a young age, Phoebe also formed fixations on men, particularly older men.
There was a fellow next door. He was a married man who had two little children. And if you go to the house, you can still see on the window a paper, an installation sort of thing that she did out of tissue paper, of two people, a man and a woman, embracing all over the man was just this tiny text she'd just written to this person. And you can still see that they're actual words. It's not just squiggles or anything. These are actual words that she has written to this man that she couldn't tell him.
The year before she died, Phoebe was living with Aunt Hampel when she became obsessed with another older man, this time her art teacher.
She would have admired him. There would have been something about him that he was probably really good at something. There was no sort of rhyme or reason. The people that she became obsessed with, and it was like an obsession. It could have been anyone.
Phoebe sent him emails demanding he have an affair with her. He accused her of stalking him, and she was kicked out of art school.
She was doing karate as well as kickboxing, and she had to do a certain amount of hours a week, so she was pretty much at the gym the entire time I was. So for a good eight hours, just training and studying, and she was just insane of how much training she was able to do. She was fast-tracked to get her black belt in 2 years, which normally takes somebody five. She had these incredibly long legs, and once she learnt how to use them properly, she was quite deadly with her kicks.
That's Sarah Howitt. She's one of Australia's top female boxers. She and Phoebe became close while they trained together under George Colivus, the head instructor at the Melbourne Fight Club.
Phoebe came in the same as any other student, looking for a place to train, to better herself physically and mentally. And to me, she found a holy place, you can almost call it.
And he showed Phoebe a particular manoeuvre to do, which was a kick thing, and she executed it right there and then and knocked him out. And he said that had never happened to him in his life. So there was that sort of focus and capacity, but there was always a gentleness. You know, she was strong, but there's no malice.
Almost everyone we spoke to also remarked how much Phoebe loved to climb things. Her friends at art school remembered one time at a party she got drunk and got on top of a building and jumped from roof to roof. She also told them that her favourite movie scene came from an art house film called The Vanishing. In it, a man recounts jumping from a first floor window onto the cobblestone street below.
Everyone has those thoughts, but no one ever jumps. So, to go against what is predestined, one must jump. I jumped. The fall was a holy event. I broke my left arm and I lost two fingers. Why did I jump? A slight abnormality in my personality, imperceptible to those around me. You could find me listed in the medical encyclopedias under sociopath.
Phoebe told her classmates, "I want my life to be like that." So, Richard, I felt it was important to include that scene from The Vanishing to illustrate how reckless people say Phoebe was and how physical she was.
Look, I can see your point, but I don't agree. I think it's a real stretch to include this scene. It's way too suggestive that Phoebe put herself in that chute when there's so much doubt. And look, really, who wants to end their life in a garbage chute?
I remember thinking if it was suicide, I don't think she would have done something so horrific for her family, because she was very deeply connected with all of her family and they were very close. But B, I think she would have done something more poetic. I think she would have jumped off a bridge, or she would have sort of, you know, dived off a waterfall, or, you know.
A bird trapped behind tall glass.
flying into its own reflection, blood-stained feathers, a broken wing. Wait, wait for the pain of new feathers. Breaking the surface of delicate skin. Wait, wait. You will fly again. Spring is here. Freedom is near. I think this is one of her last journals. She's painted in black ink and... yeah, black ink bleeds into an indifferent sky. And then she's written, "This is such an ugly tree. Ugly like the hate inside of me. I want to break away, but can't find a way out of these long, winding corridors of darkness and deceit." Yeah, I hate to think what she was trying to work through by herself.
In this series, we're going to be talking a lot about forensics and conflict and the alleged failings of the justice system.
That's right, but at the heart of it all, there's a family that's grieving the loss of a daughter and still trying to find some answers.
The days when she first died were, you know, like I just couldn't. I was in such a state of shock that I couldn't. I used to get up and, you know, when you start to wake up and you're half awake, half asleep, when you're just coming out of sleep. And for so long, I would wake up and I'd almost have forgotten that it happened because of the sleep taking it away. And then I'd wake up and I'd think, oh no, you know, that thing happened, you know, and why is the sun still shining? Mm. That's what it was like.
Yeah.
And I used to want to scream out in the street and just go, "Don't you realise, how can life go on? Are you all you people doing all your normal thing? My daughter's dead. Don't you know that?" You know, that's how I felt like for so long.
Next time on Phoebe's Fall.
There was lots of people in the house. I found that very strange, and they were all sort of in their little party clothes. To me, they were like grief junkies. Do you know what I mean? They were grief groupies.
How many years have you been a forensic pathologist?
I've been practising for well over 40 years.
Have you ever come across a case where a person has been found dead, having, you know, travelled through a garbage chute for 11 or 12 stories?
No, this is unique.
Have you ever heard of anybody going through one of these things before?
No, never. Never in my... And I've been in the waste game 30 years and I've never heard of this.
If you found any of the material in this podcast disturbing, you can call Lifeline or Beyond Blue if you're in Australia, or your local crisis service.
Phoebe's Fall is presented by Richard Baker and Michael Batchelard, with additional reporting by Nick McKenzie. Production by Tom McKendrick and Tim Young. The consulting producers are Julie Pizzetti and Siobhan McHugh. Matt Absalom Wong manages web development for the series, and our production assistants are Jake Evans and Lucy Dean. Audience development support from Dewey Cook and Michael Schlechter. Our executive producer is Michael Batchelard. You can see extra features for this series at theage.com.au/Phoebe's Fall, and while you're there, subscribe to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald for access to the best investigations, news exclusives, commentary and more. To sign up, go to theage.com.au or smh.com.au and click subscribe.